forever. Dog.
On today's episode of Weekend at Bergman's, I love this dirty town. Or as John Travolta puts it so memorably in the opening scene of the 2018 Kevin Connolly directed biopic Gotti.
Let me tell you something. New York is the greatest fucking city in the world.
That's right. We're watching two films about the Big Apple. The ups and downs, the back alleys and the boardrooms. One day you're living in a penthouse on Park Avenue. The next day you're dead in a ditch on the side of the Long Island Expressway. But that's life in the big city. Representing the art house, it's 1957's endlessly quotable Sweet Smell of Success, starring Burt Lancaster and Tony Curtis. And representing the mainstream, it's the 1987 Michael J. Fox vehicle, The Secret of My Success. Joe, are you ready?
Hey, I'm podcasting here.
Tom, are you ready?
Yeah, I am ready.
Then roll that theme song. Sing along if you know it.
We can just kind of cut it.
Every week, you and I watch two movies together. Well, not quite together, cause we watch them apart. You at your houses and me at mine. Whoa, every week, we watch the same two movies. The Cat's in the Bag and The Bag's in the River. But how do we choose these two movies? Well, one is a brilliant, beautiful work of cinematic art, the height of the medium, and the other one is mainstream. I'm talking popcorn, baby, Hollywood endings, but what happens when we watch them back to back and have to say which one we like better, and we have to be honest. Welcome, welcome to Weekend at Bergman's. We're gonna watch an art house movie and a mainstream movie, and we're gonna say which one we like better, and the one that we like better is gonna go into the canon, and the one that we did not like as much is gonna go into the trash canon, and we, the three of us, are never allowed to watch it again for the rest of our lives. That's the premise of this podcast. My name is Brett Boehm. I'm seated across from my co-host, Joe Cilio. Joe, how are you?
You know the jokes where you're like, it's not funny, but then you're like, but then he kept going, and then it was so funny. You know those jokes?
Yeah, you're saying that's what my theme song
is? Still waiting.
Okay. Joe, you're, to quote our guest, which we'll, of course, bring on in a second, bring on as quickly as we can.
Please, for the love of God.
Yeah.
You are famously Philly trash.
Thank you.
And, but you have lived in New York City.
Yeah.
How do you, in your mind, navigate that crisis? A guy from Philly who turned his back on the city of brotherly love to move to the Big Apple. How do you resolve that?
Is that how you'd put it? Turning my back on?
I just
sowed my oats, Brett. I went on a my personal life journey, and it brought me to New York City for about 9 to 10 years, and I had a great time, but it would never replace my great Philadelphia. And that is why today, despite me being dressed as Michael J. Fox in The Secret of My Success, I'm repping Philly right here. So New York knows I care about you. But you're not my first love. Mm-hmm.
That's right. That Wawa mug that you Amazon primed last night.
No, my wife bought it for me for Christmas.
Mm-hmm. Which Christmas? This most recent Christmas?
Yeah.
I think I'm making my point for me. It's a recent acquisition. since you've the
thermos, not the fact that I love Philly or went to Wawa.
The big city chewed you up and spit you out over to the West Coast, but we're happy to have you here.
Thanks.
We'll return to that, maybe that crisis later on in the episode. But without further ado, let's bring on our guest. This is very exciting. This is our first guest. Don't switch yet, Brian. We're going to intro. We'll intro him.
He already switched. Okay. I mean, for the discerning ForeverDog.plus viewer, you know who our guest is. For the discerning listener who can tell, Tom, you know, the great radio men.
List the credits. Sure. List the credits.
I mean, they're endless.
You don't know any of them.
I do know them.
Works here. He's on our network.
I know who
list
he is.
A single credit.
Yeah. Are you serious?
Yes.
Fine. Monk.
There you go.
Great.
Monk.
Great.
I did it.
You guys like Monk?
Yeah.
I did Monk.
Who doesn't like Monk?
Who doesn't?
If you don't like Monk, speak up.
You know, nobody will. That's an opinion no one will admit to in public.
Well,
because even if they don't like Monk, they know it's an unpopular.
You know
opinion.
Him from Monk.
Yeah, from Monk.
You heard of Monk?
Sure.
Is that all you know?
No, that's fine.
What else do you know?
Can I switch now?
No. Monk is just the tip of the iceberg. All right. This guy, I'll tell you what. When I moved out to California, I was the first one out here, by the way. I was here before you. Several years.
Who
I mean,
cares?
Almost a decade.
What the fuck? Who gives a shit?
Laying the groundwork.
You said that like it's impressive.
Laying the groundwork.
Joe was busy turning his back on Philadelphia.
Now we're talking. Now we're talking.
You literally, to go to New York.
Yeah.
You literally did turn your back to Philadelphia.
It's just geography.
It's the way moving from one place to another goes.
Physically, I turned my back. My soul remained full frontal. Sure.
That is indisputable, but it is just as indisputable that you did physically turn your back on Philadelphia.
I mean, right. I will say just one caveat there. Depending on which side of the train you're sitting on, the Excel Express, you could technically take the
Thank
train
you, Brett.
To
actually,
New York
that's an excellent
while
point.
You're facing
Many
Philly.
Times you get in Penn Station, you do the backwards
but that's
train.
Not what you did. You
sat
you,
in the front, you, the front train, the front going
hopped
train.
Hopped in your car, you rode out of town, you never looked back.
Mm-hmm. I don't understand.
I'm just curious. I want to get to know you better. I want to know, you know, you fully.
You
and I feel like
that,
this is probably.
This is how you get to know somebody?
I'm going
to
assume that this is a key part of your psyche, this battle in your head.
Any Philadelphia.
I betrayed my roots. I betrayed my origins.
Any Philadelphian would feel the same way. So you're scratching a wound.
Not right. Enough about you. Let's talk more about our guest. So
I'm not talking about me. You keep
so in addition to Monk,
I said Monk already. What more can we possibly
this guy
want?
Created and has hosted the best audio content in the history of this country. I'm just going to come out and
thank
say
you.
It. Truly,
it's probably
truly,
true. Actually,
truly,
Tom,
I mean, prove me wrong.
I mean, it's you and the 1,000-year-old man are neck and neck right now. But you have more years left. You
For
know
a
what
second,
mean? So
I
probably,
thought I was ass kissing as I was hearing, but then it came out and it sat there, and I was like, I don't think that's wrong.
Not ass kiss.
Okay,
not anymore.
The best show, you know it. And then most recently, co-host of just the best damn comedy podcast out there. Mm-hmm. In addition to the best show, Double Threat, along with co-host Julie Klausner. What an honor to have him as a part of the Forever Dog family. I'm, of course, talking about Tom Sharpe.
Well,
we can bring him up on the
you
screen
so
now.
Much.
There he is.
So
there
exciting.
He is.
I appreciate it.
You're looking great.
Thank you. I want to say, though, Joe.
Yes, Tom.
Give it to him.
You don't need that Wawa thermos for people to know you're from Philly. I would spot you as a Philly guy from a mile away.
Hey, this is just about making sure that everybody mm-hmm. knows, despite my looks today, Mr. New York, I'm still Jenny from the block.
All
that's
I would
what
say,
this is right here.
Mm-hmm. And that last sentence you just told us when you said the word nose. Nose.
Yeah.
We know you're from Philly. And look, Brett's from Georgia.
Oh, yeah.
Who's
I'm Georgia trash. Yeah.
Who's he to talk?
He never lived in New York, and he's given me guff.
That's right. I never lived in New York. I wouldn't dare. Where did those scratches come from? Were you out last night chucking that thing against a brick wall to age it up a little bit? No, on the Wawa.
No.
That's Philly. These Philly guys ride hard.
Just
right?
from taking it in and out of my car after work.
All right. Yeah, just a Philly guy. Just a poor old Philly guy.
I feel like you're harping on my thermos because you didn't prep for the podcast today. Is mm-hmm. that is that sort of what,
you
what's happening?
Wait, no, I wore this?
It's a guess.
I'm dressed as these are both New York movies. I'm dressed as Statue of Liberty, of course. You know I presume a prominent figure in New York culture. I don't really know. Okay,
everyone in New York's familiar with Statue of Liberty.
Okay, so Statue of Liberty. But then I also added a few little J.J. Hunsaker touches here. The glasses. These are not the ones I was looking for. Hollywood Twain costume did not have the. The you know black rimmed on the top that I was looking for. That's fine. That was a hard ask.
Sure.
I get it.
No, this is my favorite costume that you've brought to the
Thank
program.
Thank you. And a little cigarette.
It's awesome. You got the little cigarette.
Yeah. Not a real
Folks,
cigarette.
Folks, this is Brett's best costume. You can only find it on foreverdog.plus.
Absolutely.
You'll be able to watch video episodes of A Weekend at Bergman's, but you'll also be able to watch video episodes. You'll also be able to watch video episodes of Double Threat every week, right sent to your inbox. foreverdog.plus, all of that and more.
That's how it works, Forever Dog.
$5.
Plus. That's, what a deal.
$5.
What a deal.
And then when you're making your stir fry, mm-hmm. little tofu stir fry, Got sure. a little bean sprouts in there. You got a little, mm-hmm. you got a little beans. You got a little.
So New York.
You're working hard to red pepper. You're working hard to not sound Philly by talking about bean sprouts and tofu.
I don't mind sounding like Philly. What about you in New Jersey? Like you're Mr. New. I know you're not Mr. New Jersey.
No,
you're
Mr. Good. Let's get into that's it. A huge compliment.
You're Mr. New Jersey.
Yeah.
Right. You
King
you,
of the Garden State.
You are all the you to me in my life have embodied all the wonderful things about the Garden
you're
State.
You're sweet. I grew up with Philly and New York as huge influences on me because when you're in New Jersey, you're between these two major cities and they both have their own identities and they're both have their own attitudes, but you're neither of them because they both look down on you. They both look down on you. The Philly people and the New York people look down on New Jersey people.
I didn't fully know that was the hierarchy. I thought Philly and New Jersey were kind of level. Under
no.
The, Jersey's a rung below.
Oh, yeah.
New, wow. Philly,
well,
how dare
New
you?
Jersey's a,
how dare you?
Well, just think New Jersey's a state, and it's kind of diffused throughout a state. Philly is a major city.
It's a big city. It's a big city.
And you think about who's come out of Philly.
Everybody.
Right?
Everybody.
I mean, Jimmy Butler most recently.
He came Why? Out, yes.
Why you got to do?
Yeah.
Oh, but Ben Franklin and
The rest.
Yeah, and the rest.
Yeah.
Waste of Men and the rest.
Well, Tom, speaking of that, I wanted to because you picked this pairing for us today. This is a Sharpling choice. I was so excited when I heard this pairing. I think it makes so much sense. How did this come to you? What did you think of this pairing?
Well, funnily enough, maybe this will be the first time on the show as I'm a first time. The first guest on the show.
The
so
first
I guess
guest.
It might be, but I don't know if either of you have, in preparation for an episode, seen one of the two movies in a theater. Because I did see Sweet Smell of Success at the New Beverly about 3 or so weeks ago.
Oh, cool.
And then I said to Brett in the Forever Dog hallways, I said, what about Sweet Smell of Success and Secret of My Success? As a pairing, because I had just seen Sweet Smell of Success on a 35mm print at the New Beverly in Los Angeles.
Wow. How was that?
It was beautiful. It's a beautiful movie.
Yeah. And as we'll say later on, the DP James Wong Howe, famous cinematographer. I mean, this movie is, you forget because it's so well written. This movie's gorgeous.
Oh, absolutely.
Gorgeous black and white.
Looks as
film.
Cool as can be.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Tom, speaking of that kind of New Jersey, New York matrix, the relationship between those two things, because Secret of My Success, I was so glad you chose that one because that was a Turner Cable staple when I was growing up. I must have seen that movie on TBS, TNT like 10 times. So I hadn't watched it. I haven't seen it in 20, 25 years, but kind of grew up on that movie. And it was honestly one of the movies that kind of framed my understanding of New York, which is, we'll talk about what that all entails. But when you were growing up, I mean, you were so close to New York, but what were the movies and TV shows, if any, that kind of framed your, you know, your understanding of New York, the myth of New York, all that kind of stuff?
Sure. Well, I mean, I would say in terms of there are movies and there are television shows that framed it, but a couple of things that are not those, like music did, because like liking like the Ramones as a kid and, you know, Rocket to Rush was one of the first albums I bought. And just New York was this place just that was 45 minutes away. And I also would go in regularly with my parents because they needed to go in for work purposes because they, for retail, buying t-shirts for imprinted, which is what they did, screen printing, they would go in and we would go to the garment district and spend the day in New York a lot of time. So I had a lot of experience taking day trips into Manhattan with that. But I would say Saturday Night Live was huge because it's like this, that's happening so close to me. Like David Letterman was huge because it was like a talk show that was not a Los Angeles talk show. It's like, oh, this is a New York talk show. And it has some whole other energy that's so different than what The Tonight Show was at that point. So it felt like that. You could just feel there was some energy attached to so many of these things. And then movie-wise, I mean, like Ghostbusters was huge because it's like all these adventures are happening in New York. Marvel Comics were huge because they all took so many of them were in Manhattan. Like Doctor Strange is walking around the village and just like that was huge.
It must be great too to have a like pre-80s Wall Street. Like you already had a understanding of New York before all that stuff happened, because I know this was Secret of My Success was one of the first one of my first exposures to kind of New York, the myth of New York, what seeing it on TV and the movies. And so I like before understanding all of the cultural history of New York, just thought of it as like a business center where you went to make a lot of money. And it was it's just kind of we'll talk about that more. But watching these two movies back to back, it's so interesting of what the because New York, I think, has always represented this like you go there to make it and you start at the bottom and you got to work your way up. But what you're working towards and what worlds you're sort of moving through, that's changed so much over the course of, I think, you know, the 20th century. And yeah, it kind of sucks to have the like that 80s version of it be my first exposure because it was it was very cool to then learn about everything else. But yeah, my first memory of New York was like, oh, that's where you go to like be a big business success. And that's kind of what New York represents.
Sure. Secret of My Success.
Secret of My Success.
That was your New York.
Yes. Right. That's my New York. Yes. I wanted to play a quick game with you, Tom, if that's all right.
Oh, of course.
As I mentioned in the intro, you know, the New York ladder goes in both directions. You can either end up in a penthouse apartment or dead in a ditch. And so I wanted to present to you some I'm going to list out some just some characters, some fictional characters and other kind of characters. And I want you to tell me you have two choices here. If these characters showed up in New York, you know, fresh off the bus from wherever, with just, you know, a bindle over their shoulder and a couple bucks, are they going to end up in a penthouse apartment or are they going to end up dead in a ditch?
Sure.
All right. And usually I usually have a theme song. I didn't have time to write a custom theme song for this segment.
Well, just do it to really the tune of Happy Birthday. That'll be about as creative as it would
Well, there was too many. The segment is called Penthouse Apartment or Dead in a Ditch. Just I couldn't find anything that would scan happy for birthday. That. No, I'm going to stick with my original plan. I'm just going to play New York Groove behind it. I just don't. We'll just sort of have this playing in the background. It'll be fun.
If you say so.
Oops, sorry. I have other stuff. Oh,
this is fun. You're right.
Man. Cherish.
This is awesome.
One of those New York anthems. The Association.
So it turns out when you leave,
this is awesome.
When you leave, different drum on, that's what comes on the YouTube playlist five songs
this
later.
Is great.
All right.
Do you own a podcast company?
Here we go. Ooh. All right, let's play Penthouse Apartment or Dead in a Ditch with our guest Tom Sharpling. First up, Bugs Bunny.
Well, Penthouse Apartment is his call.
Second, Mickey Mouse.
Dead in the Ditch.
Third, Bez from the Happy Mondays.
Both.
Fourth, the Philly Fanatic.
Dead in the Ditch.
Fifth, an old friend of Double Threat, the Crypt Keeper.
Penthouse Apartment.
Number six, that sweet little orphan Oliver Twist.
Dead in a Ditch.
Number seven, Ronald McDonald. Tough one.
Ronald McDonald, I see him gaming the system. Penthouse Apartment.
He's like the Jordan Belfort.
He'd figure it out, yeah.
Number eight, Kermit the Frog.
Kermit the Frog. Dead in a Ditch. Look, hey, it's a rough city.
There's two options. It only goes one of two ways.
Can we talk about that for one second?
Please.
But all his work, you know, behind the scenes on The Muppet Show, you don't think that would sort of, you know, he's shucked a lot of hands.
Sure. Well, when the ditch is calling, you go meet the ditch.
It's a vote of no confidence for Kermit.
You know what the biggest lie in the world is? That old thing, you can never cheat an honest man. You can cheat an honest man. Honest men get cheated and screwed over all the time. So I think Kermit the Frog has a lot of integrity, but that's not going to save him in the big city. I think dead in the ditch as well.
It also gets assuming that Kermit the Frog isn't like cooking the books on The Muppet Show, that theater. Like he's not just cheaping out
some of it. Okay.
The show falls apart every week. What do you think that's about? But somebody's cutting corners.
He's an LA frog.
He's a very much an LA frog.
He's an LA frog.
Yes.
Number nine. This is another Double Threat reference here. Number nine. The entire population of Lake Wobegon showing up together and working in unison as a group.
walk them right off the bus into the ditch. They are not going to cut it.
Okay. That tracks.
And number 10, a movie that we're actually going to watch on Weekend at Bergman's in a couple weeks, Nosferatu, the vampire Nosferatu.
Oh, it's Penthouse Apartment.
Absolutely. That's my thought, too.
Wow.
That was Penthouse Apartment or Dead in a Ditch. Mm-hmm. Thank you for playing, Tom.
Thank you for the game. I love games.
That was a lot of fun.
Nothing funnier than games, right, Tom?
No, I love all the great shows have games on them.
Right.
Jimmy Fallon, James Corden.
Yes. There's nothing.
Weekend at Bergman's.
Nothing comedy sort of screams more than just a stupid game with some fucking music that you like and just sort of words you know and just sort of sure. just sort of opinions.
This is what I was dying to see was this. The back and forth.
Tom, I mean,
here's the thing. I'm not mad.
Dead in a ditch or in a penthouse? Kermit the Frog.
I'm not even mad because I just don't know. I don't even know how you would fill space. I don't even know how you would fill time.
What about the fucking movies?
Well, we'll get to that. You ever heard of a three-act structure? A show should have a beginning, a middle, and end. We are now in the middle. Well, that would make the movies the end. I mean, this is, I guess it's more of a five-act structure. But either way, I'm approaching this with some sure. sense of order. I mean,
yeah.
right, Tom?
No, no.
Yeah,
no,
that, right, look, you know what? That famous... Yeah. That classic cinematic five-act structure.
Yeah. All right, look. Look, we're being a little hard. We're being a little hard. I have a confession to make.
Oh, great.
I liked the game. All right.
Yes, yeah.
I had fun playing
you
the game.
You were wearing it all over your face.
It made me laugh. Yeah. It made me smile. Tom's answers were funny. Thank the game you. Was good.
It's okay? a great game.
The game was yeah. good. I'm sorry.
Let's get into our movies. So the movies that we watched, the two movies we watched today, Sweet Smell of Success from 1957 and The Secret of My Success from 1987. A mere 30 years separate these movies. And yet the gulf between their quality, I think we can honestly say, is quite large. This is one of those weeks, unless I'm speaking out of turn here, some weeks we go in, we're torn, we're divided. We don't know what we're going to do. It's truly... you know, psychologically torturous, it's knowing torture. That one of these movies we're never going to watch again. Then there are other weeks where it's just, ooh, we're just slamming on one movie and celebrating another. Unless I'm speaking out of turn, I feel like maybe that's the way this week is going to go, unless there's any objections to that.
Not for me.
No objections here.
So let's start then with this, ooh, this real piece of crap here. Secret of My Success from 1987. We'll get that one out of the way first. It was produced and directed by a pretty illustrious director, Herbert Ross. Before the show started, Tom was reading out some of Herbert Ross's credits.
Play It Again, Sam. The Last of Sheila. Funny Lady. Wow. Sunshine Boys. The Owl and the Pussycat. The Goodbye Girl, California Suites. We did a couple of Neil Simons there. Pennies from Heaven, Steve Martin's dramatic debut.
Remake of the Bob Hoskins show. Yeah.
Footloose.
Really?
Yeah. Steel Magnolias.
What? I guess everybody, look, sometimes you just got to work, you know? And Michael J. Fox. And,
yeah,
you know,
sure. You know, I'm going to say this thing, wasn't Herbert's know? Fault then. I mean, no, that's a pretty impressive body of work there.
Herbert has to work. You know?
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah. And it was written by A.J. Carruthers. It was filmed on location in Manhattan. Joe, if you wouldn't
it
mind.
It captured zero of the majesty of the opportunity to film in New York. Whether you like New York or not, we can all admit there's a great romance, especially mm-hmm. in a legacy of romance for the city on film.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most filmed and gorgeously shot cities and brought the world to New York via the medium of film. Mm. So when you tell me that the secret of my success was shot on location
on
in
location.
Manhattan, I want the audience to understand that it captured absolutely nothing of the city.
Well, for people who haven't seen the film, why don't you give us one of your classic 60-second recaps? You ready?
Oh my gosh, I am. Let's give it a try.
Here we go.
Michael J. Fox plays a young whippersnapper from Kansas. You know it because he's literally shoving hay in the first like 3 seconds. That's what they do in Kansas on the farm. He's not wearing a shirt. He's just shoveling hay onto a pile of hay. It doesn't matter. He's from Kansas, and he's going to New York to get a job. When he gets to New York, he realizes that company is folding. He has to find another job. He meets up with his uncle, who owns a big firm. God knows what industry it is. They don't bother to tell you. He runs a big firm, and he puts Michael J. Fox down in the mailroom, but that doesn't satisfy Michael J. Fox. He pretends to be another guy. He learns the ways of the company. He pretends to be a guy. He gets in a fake office. He gets a secretary, and he's tricking everybody, which leads to a good old-fashioned comedy of errors where everybody's running around and he's changing costumes seconds. And then he's the mailroom version. Then he's the business version. But the uncle's like, let me meet this new whippersnapper, but Michael J. Fox can't be seen. And then they all go to the country and it's like Midsummer Night's Dream, but not good or Shakespeare or funny. And then it ends mercifully.
All right. That was a 60-second recap of The Secret of My Success. Tommy, you think there's any key details he left out there?
No, that actually captured the plot of this movie. Was Michael J. Fox is a young go-getter, and he's trying to make it at any price, but he needs to make it on his own terms is the thing he's decided. Yeah. That he's not going to sleep his way to the top. That just like, who knew that was an option for...
He will milk his like family relationships. Sure. I mean, he's very
he
adamant.
Didn't want that, to, but he had to.
Yeah.
But he's always, he still remains adamant that he's going to do it on his own.
Yeah.
Even after having just gone to his uncle's firm and asked for a job.
Yeah. He's like, I'm going to do it on my own, and then asks his uncle, who owns a company, to hire him for something. But the movie still implies that he's doing it on his own. So then, but he goes and he lies about being this executive. And he's playing both sides of the thing. He's still running around the mailroom with some guy who was like a Bradley Whitford knockoff. Yeah. That I was just like, wait, is that Bradley Whitford? Yeah. Seems like Bradley Whitford's uncle or something. Yeah. Or like, exactly. Where just like he had the same look, but then like Bradley Whitford would like fine tune it and get it right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that guy was in Mad About You, right? Wasn't he
Paul Reiser's brother
in Mad About You? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. His buddy.
And in every movie, it always has that great moment in every one of this breed of comedy from a certain area where, I'm not going to, no spoilers.
You can spoil.
All the characters team up in the end, and like a guy like that walks in and he even scores a minute. He like shoves some like files in someone's hand. He's like, "Here, why don't you take these?"
Yeah.
Like he gets to put someone in their place. Every one of those movies has that moment where they show the so-called bosses who's the actual boss.
And one of those bosses, the guy who's coming in to buy the company, is Fred Gwynne, a little Fred Gwynne cameo at the very end.
Love my friend. I think he was the highlight Munster. Of the film.
Yes. And that was John Pankow is the buddy. John Pankow then went on to Mad About You. But yeah, Tom, I mean, this movie is so much... It's like the opposite side of the coin from Weekend at Bernie's, which we watched earlier, on our first episode. In that Weekend at Bernie's, I just loved how funny it was, how self aware it was about the 80s and about 80s excess and all this stuff. And I think really you can argue is a satire of all that excess. This movie is in love with like the Wall Street dream of the 80s. I mean, it's almost propaganda for that kind of that moment.
It's basically training people to be just work machines.
Yeah.
And celebrating the idea that you exist for work and only for work, and that is the only way to prove your worth and to validate you. Because Michael J. Fox wants this job. Ostensibly, he wants the job that his uncle / boss he wants to be one of the people that can be close to him working for him. And then every time they show the people working right under the boss, they're just buffoons.
Yeah.
And they're like just losers. Yeah. But he's striving for one of those jobs. Like that would be his dream come true, to be one of the people who gets to run around the track on the roof of the building with his uncle as one of his chosen executives. But those executives are just like they're just like animals in the movie.
Yeah,
that's a great point. I don't understand the aspiration. He seems to revel in only one element of the job, which is being able to sort of like lean over secretaries' desks and like kind of like do like a nudge kind of a joke. I don't really see him taking advantage of any other elements. He doesn't like get a company car. He doesn't get like a boat. He doesn't really make a lot of money. He still lives in like his original place. He never takes advantage of any of the upgrades of the lifestyle. The only thing that he sort of takes advantage of is sort of strutting around like an asshole and kind of leaning, sitting on people's desks and kind of giving them a look.
He simultaneously, like, his main drive is to be liked, I think. His, like, main thing is that he really wants to be liked and accepted. And it's the culture more than, like, any... Yeah, he's, like, weirdly, like, non-materialistic. You think of this... Yeah,
but, he is in certain ways, though. Yeah. He's hung up on flying back home on a private plane.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's, like, a thing. Like there are things... He's 100% obsessed with being liked and with people being impressed by him.
Yes,
like those are the things that make him, that fuel him, is you will be impressed by me. And I do think he is maybe more materialistic once he gets a chance to, because he always talked about, I want the apartment, I want the... this, I want that. Like, those are the things when he talked to his mother about the things he's striving for.
That's a good point because he's not actually getting any money. He's doing two jobs and he's pretending to be an executive, but he's just getting paid as though he works in the mailroom.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So the materialism he can't act on yet, but surely once he can, he will take
2 years from where this movie ends, he will be literally just be his uncle.
Yeah.
Correct. I guess then just critical of the comedy. So it's like, okay, so you have a fish out of water thing where this Kansas kid is now up in the big league of executive suite and he has to pretend to be a boss. You think that would just yield just hours of gags, or just like we can sit around and think of like 50 different things he could do to play up that sort of tension, that fish out of water scenario. He doesn't take advantage of any of the comedy opportunities.
They barely do any fish out of water stuff.
I don't know why not. He just kind of struts around, sits on a desk, makes advances on all of the women in the office, and then you're right, he does talk about what he's going to do later. Famously not a great thing to do in your movie, like, go ahead and activate that. Why don't you put him on a plane and have him pretend to be rich and not know the rule, you know, just do any sort of comedic premise. Because and the same thing happens in Act 3 where, great, it's going to be a Scooby-Doo Midsummer Night's Dream run around sex comedy.
Oh my God, whose bed? That montage.
So at
is
the end, they
endless.
All. So just to. Do you mind if I go on right here? Do you want to do something?
No, please.
Just a quick catch of the audience up. Please don't watch the movie to like follow along with the podcast. Let me just tell you, something bizarre happens. Michael J. Fox in the mailroom is asked to drive the boss's wife home.
Vera.
He drives the boss's
wife. Not knowing it's the boss's wife. Just drive.
Thank you.
Yes. Drive. This woman
drive this woman home. He drives her out to her fancy house and she makes serious, significant advances on him, which culminates in a showgirls adjacent pool sex scene. But this
how
one,
dare you.
We talked about how in Verhoeven it was like played as if it could be horror. This one literally has the Jaws soundtrack underneath of it as she sort of destroys Michael J. Fox in this pool setting.
Just when I thought it was safe to go back in the water.
The Jaws thing is so interesting because it truly felt like you're saying, it truly felt like they didn't plan out the movie. It, like, a lot of the stuff is like almost like day of decisions, it feels like. Like the Jaws thing is so bizarre.
I don't know. I think they're
just
trying
to be funny.
And
he even quotes Jaws. He says like you know what, you can't go in the water again or something. It's like, but it's a very half-baked
idea. I think this is like the 80s version of, you know, in Free Guy with Ryan Reynolds when he's like, hey, look, it's Darth Vader. You know, it's just that sort of, you know.
Yeah.
Hey, oh, Jaws. Remember that a couple summers ago?
Yeah, they're like
popular.
Grasping at like accessibility. Like, what are the things we can do that's just accessible to people? And
So Michael J. Fox has had sex with who he learns at the end of this scene is his aunt. It's the boss's wife. Oh my God. Anyway, this whole sort of, and then the boss is dating his love interest, who's the only female executive at the firm for whom he has no respect at all. It's fun. It'd be funny if it wasn't bizarre and sad. So anyway, at the end, basically in Act 3, they all go away for the weekend for some big corporate retreat party-esque sort of scenario that involves what comedically could be, you know, it's my favorite kind of scene. It's a good old fashioned noises off sex farce. And I'm like, okay, can Act 3 salvage this? Cause they're all snooping around, getting into each other's beds. Just fertile comedic ground, zero laughs.
Well, it's like they're in
no laughs.
It's like they're in an M.C. Escher painting. The montage lasts for like like what felt like 5 minutes, and you lose track of where everybody is.
They did it so poorly.
It's so like it's there's no sense of tension. You never know if someone's around the corner from somebody else.
Just watch any Scooby-Doo.
They're lost in a maze at this point. Yeah,
there's no wide shot of somebody going through a door and somebody going past the door after the door shuts. Like in every one of those farces, there's the classic wide shot of all the doors, and this one comes out of this one. That there's literally nothing like that. It's all close-ups of reactions. And it's set the one unique thing about this movie is there are two full montages set to Yellow's Oh Yeah.
Oh Yeah.
Yes, there are. This movie is 1 hour and 11 minutes long. Six of those minutes are the song Oh Yeah.
He's in the limo with Vera, which you talked about, and Vera's so, like seducing him, but also just like putting on makeup.
Gearing up to sexually assault him.
Yes.
She fillets a lipstick.
Yeah. Yes.
Because he complimented her once.
Yes.
And then they show them running around to this song the second time. You're just like, well, this just feels like old people thinking that this is what kids want. And I think because Oh Yeah was in Ferris Bueller's
famously a year earlier.
So then they were just like, well, let's put that one from the Ferris Bueller in this.
Bueller, we'll do Jaws, we'll do all that.
It worked when we cut it.
We'll do
to
Scooby-Doo
that.
Doors, we won't do it good, but yeah.
That feels like the one, like a lot of times they cut a thing together and they use this temp music. And then people fall in love with the temp music. They're just like, we should go with the...
Yeah.
They're like, look, we'll cut it to Oh Yeah, and then we'll find the right song. But then they're just like, it's really working with Oh Yeah. Which one? Both.
Both.
Sometimes these stars get to a point. At this point, Michael J. Fox was as big as you could get. Mm-hmm. It's like post-Family Ties, post-Back to the Future. Mm-hmm. He's as big as it gets. He shows up in this movie... He's not playing Brantford or whatever. What was his name?
Yeah, Brantley.
Brantley. He's playing Michael J. Fox.
Yeah.
He's doing all his tricks.
Right.
He's stammering and all guys. And then he's jumping out of thing and kind of like clumsily jumping through things. He's just doing Michael J. Fox all through. It's a star move. It's when you realize you're a certain level of fame when you show up and you do your thing that they want you to do. And it's just like this is that point in his career where he's just like, the script can be garbage, I'll just do some Michael J. Fox crap and that'll put us over the top. And I really feel like the Jaws stuff and the other things, I if I had to guess, they were cutting this movie and it just wasn't that funny. So they're just like, well, what if we do a Jaws thing here? What if we do these things? So they're doing like these little like they're trying to like goose the comedy in it because the actual stuff isn't working. And final point, when he's in the pool and she's pulling his bathing suit off, you clearly see the skin colored briefs he's wearing so clearly that it's insane that it's that clear in the movie.
It's so clear that you have to like interpret it as like in the universe of the movie. Like you have to interpret like that character is wearing
until
them.
This moment. I figured that in the 80s men were just more demure and they wore some sort
they
of
wore
speedo
a second underneath.
And why was his skin color? I was like, it was just so brazen and
the movie
just forces
so you
clear. I was just like, I guess that was a thing.
You have
no
to.
Choice.
It's so obvious.
I guess that was a choice.
There, I call it, to me, it's like the Bazooka Joe theory of things, where it's like sometimes you read a Bazooka Joe comic and it's so stupid that you almost aren't sure if you got it or not. Like you're just like, wait a minute, this has to be a different joke here. I almost am... Am I not smart enough for a Bazooka Joe thing? But you're so beyond it that you actually can't believe somebody would put that out there as comedy.
This movie has a
lot of that in it, where you're like, this is so stupid.
Where do we stand on Michael J. Fox? just in general, and just to just look, enough times passed, we can all be honest about it.
And I will say, after watching, after this viewing, and we always on Weekend Bergman's, you watch with clean eyes, you watch, you watch as though you've never seen it before. Yeah. I felt the need to reevaluate Michael J. Fox. I don't really like blame him per se, though. No. I think he is just, I feel like he is being poorly treated by this movie because he really feels like just a this movie truly watches like just propaganda for the 80s, and he feels like just a tool that's being used to like add some charisma and charm to that, mm-hmm. to that ideology of like wealth and work is the are the only goals. And he makes that seem human. He makes that all kind of, because he's like, he's really, none of these characters are really that different in their goals. Like some of them are a little more devious or this or that. But like the love interest, Christy, played by Helen Slater, who's like Michael J. Fox's love interest in this movie, is a terrible person. Her, like, she's like adamant that they need to like shut down multiple entire Midwest factories. Mm-hmm. She's just like, just as ruthless of a kind of Wall Street capitalist as you can be. So I feel like Michael J. Fox, like Tom was saying, is brought in here to just do the Michael J. Fox thing, to add some, to make this whole like vision of the world palatable. But then I was looking at some of his other credits from around this time, and like, man, he was really playing a lot of assholes. Like, and you don't know at the time because he is so charming, but like movies like Doc Hollywood and this and that, like he's just, he kind of, you know, whereas like Andrew McCarthy, who had a similar dynamic, I think had got some more interesting roles that hold up a little bit better. Yeah, man, Michael J. Fox was just getting a lot of crap post Back to the Future.
He really embodied this like 80s attitude of like, it's almost like the comedy version of like Stallone or something, where it's just like, it's just, it's kind of, you're kind of just getting bullied a little bit by somebody. If Michael J. Fox was going to do what he does in other eras now, he would have been the villain in most movies. He would have been the jerk off who loses, not the hero of these movies, because he's it's like a post Bill Murray snarky, too cool for school thing that he became the face of. And in like Back to the Future, it's well served because he's up against larger forces. But in things like this, he just smirks his way through the whole thing.
Yeah.
And you're just like, it's kind of repulsive.
Yeah. And he just ends the movie as like the new CEO of like a conglomerate.
He literally has his hair slicked back at the end of the movie.
Yeah. Where did he get the money to buy the firm? From Vera?
From Vera.
But at the end of the movie, Michael J. Fox teams up with his aunt, who he had sleeping with unwillingly, and convinces her to buy out the company that he works at from the mailroom from his uncle, who's a jerk. But not only that, they also put together enough money to also buy the company that's trying to do a hostile takeover of the company Michael J. Fox works at. So Michael J. Fox convinces Vera to buy not one, but like two massive Wall Street, you know, hedge funds or whatever they're buying, whatever they are,
in an hour.
And he sort of runs into a room.
Yeah,
it's just, you know, it strains credulity, like many comedic premises in this horror.
Brian,
can we go to
126:30? This is a scene that I think represents a lot of what we're talking about. This is the scene where Vera, they're out at this like country club for this weekend where all these like business leaders are meeting.
It's very funny.
And this, there's a couple things happening here that are like common throughout the movie. One, this movie, and I think this has to do with what Tom was saying about like getting into the editing room and being like, what the hell do we do with all this footage? Is like, there are so many montages with no dialogue. So many montages that are just like set to some like silly song. That's how they're going to get you from point A to point B in the plot, is like, well, we don't have the dialogue for it, so let's just do a montage thing and that'll get us. And, you know, of course, every movie relies on montages. This movie has like seven or eight montages. And all the scenes we've been talking about are montage scenes. The limo, the like creeping around the house. The first time he sees his love interest is bizarre. It almost switches to like an art house like aesthetic for a second. It's so crazy.
She bends over to drink out of the water fountain.
Yes,
but, first, but her lips don't drink water. She just puts her lips up to the water.
Yeah, actually, sorry, Brian, that's 1552. Let's look at that real quick.
Anyway, then there's like a whole dream sequence, but just whatever. Just,
well, for that scene also, I want to say when he meets all the rich guys who eventually help him out later, I'm 95% sure Jeffrey Epstein is acting in this scene. No, I'm kidding. It's just like there's a guy who looks shockingly like Jeffrey Epstein.
With this movie, I would go
it would be just like,
it's Epstein.
Hey, Jeffrey's a...
Yeah, hey, Jeffrey. He's like an associate producer. He threw in a couple million. He wants to be in the movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
I buy it. I mean, all right. So this is the Love at First Sight montage. And we like briefly...
Oh, good. We have it.
It's like we go into... Last year in Marion Bond for 2 minutes.
Before
in this
movie. Did anybody else have a hard time with his Kansas accent that he developed?
I couldn't understand a thing.
He's supposed to literally be right off the farm, and he's just talking like Michael J. Fox. But that's the fame part of it, where he's just like, "You're from Kansas." He's like, "Okay, I'm gonna just be from Kansas." And it's like, "Any chance you want to work any kind of thing?" Yeah. Nope.
It's such an old fad because like you would see that all the time with like Cary Grant, where you'd be watching a Cary Grant movie and then halfway through you find out he's French and you're just like, what?
Yeah,
what?
But he's not. Michael J. Fox is not a Cary Grant make.
Yeah.
You know, all right, I have more leeway for Cary.
Let's watch the Love at First Sight montage. I think this is around. Yeah, here we go.
Yeah, what?
Oh, just the marble.
All right. So he's drinking water and it's kind of regular. All right, here's just a woman asking if she can use the water fountain.
Helen Supergirl
Slayer. He gets in her way and stares her down. Bizarre. Now there's like an insert of.
Yeah, she just presses her lips to the water.
She just wants like wet lips.
Yeah. You don't just go to a water fountain and just
wet hold your. You gotta suck.
Hold your lips under for.
Okay,
Michael J. Fox. Michael J. Fox. Now we go to
what?
Dream sequence.
Now it's
I don't know what
perfume commercial.
It is. It's a perfume commercial.
What
it is
fuck?
Like all the '80s aesthetics
are
like
now the room
melting
is
into each
out
other.
And it's just her, and she's wearing a pink. You know, she's going to a wedding dress.
He's still at the water fountain though, which is a weird choice.
They shoot the movie. All the comedy is shot so confusedly that it contributes further to there not being any laughs in
now this
film.
Seems to be like a visual metaphor
kind? What's romantic and interesting about her spinning around in the rotating it's like they looked around
haunting.
The lobby and they're like, okay, why don't you can spin around in there, you can maybe you can go ahead and dance around the area, let's just do some whimsical things that suggest dream sequence.
All right, we can stop there. And then can you go
what
back to Brian, can you go back to 126:30 and we'll
what
watch
is
that country
what
club
is that
sing?
Communicating that she's the only one in his eyes and nobody else can be seen. It's just like she's drinking out of a water fountain, then she's walking around in a pink dress, and then she's back in her regular clothes spinning around in the rotating doors.
It's haunting. It doesn't like communicate what they want it to communicate, which is just like, let's do a love at first sight thing. And they like everything slows down and they make eye contact. But their version of and it's like the creeping around the house. These are not hard. Just like follow the playbook on the thing.
Yeah.
Just like
they do
the
done it 10,000 times. Just copy.
Yeah,
nothing wrong with copying some how you shoot the bits. No big
and
deal.
Also any adult, this might be more my personal bias.
No, bring it.
Any adult drinking out of a water fountain like that should be arrested.
So you say adults don't drink in water fountains?
Not like that. They don't. They shouldn't.
Okay.
Wait, that's a giveaway.
How does an adult drink
general
water
principles?
Fountain?
We'll bring you down to the station and sort it out.
If the water goes up, it's got to go down your throat. She is just like splashing. Not only is she just like lightly splashing her lips, all that water is going back into the general.
I've come out as a fervently anti how she drinks out of a water fountain.
Let's watch this other scene. Yeah, this is another montage, but this one was so bizarre to me because it's kind of the whole movie in a nutshell, where they play, this is where Brantley is starting to just network with other rich businessmen at this country club, which is, like Tom was saying, is like a, it's like what the villain does. This is like what the villain does in movies, is they like, they're on the inside of the country club. They're the snobs, and you don't like them.
This is who he gets on his team to go buy both of the big companies.
This is when he's putting, this is when he's putting together the plan to kind of hijack the company, right? Oh, and Vera is like showing him around.
Most other movies would have him start to realize the error of his ways now. Not realize
what have I become?
I still want to become more like one of these guys.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
Like
you're right.
He would be real. He would say like, "Hey, you guys are still going to go forward and trash the companies in the Midwest. I'm from the Midwest. This is wrong. You don't have any feel for real people." There's like none of that in this. Yeah. When he suggests, "Hey, we should save those companies. We should expand." He's not saying it to help out people in the heartland.
No.
He's saying it just because he thinks it will make them more money.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good point.
That's the best you can hope for, is like you coincidentally save the factories in the Midwest. But that's not the driving impulse. He is loving networking with all these guys at the country club. And the music they play under it and the way they shoot it, it's like a sentimental montage of just of like upper crust 80s wealth. This is a truly troubling scene. Let's go ahead and watch it.
There's Jeffrey Epstein.
He really, really does look like Epstein.
And so Vera's like, meet this guy. Shake hands. They're chatting about whatever.
You want to go to my island?
The ponies or whatever. Yeah. And meet this guy with the chihuahua. This is a cute dog.
This is the most powerful man in New York.
Yeah.
He's doing the left-handed shake, the left-handed grab and shake. Look at that little boy. Pets his chihuahua. I imagine that's
but
comedy.
Now he's holding the chihuahua. Look.
Oh, he's learning. He's learning the ways of wealth.
Charm the dog.
They're in a literal gazebo.
What do you think he's talking to them about? He works in the mailroom. He got here two weeks ago. What could he possibly be telling? I guess the CEOs of like Fortune 500 companies have literally no idea what the fuck's going on at their company anyway.
Yeah. Vera's impressed. So. She's like, oh, he's a wunderkind. He knows all the ways of the world
and money.
Now he's at on a gazebo.
What's he explaining?
Lecturing them all about their own businesses. Now more people want
to
hear.
They're flocking to him.
Which it's is truly, genius.
He's standing in a gazebo just extemporaneously going on about business. He graduated from college 2 weeks ago and moved to New York. Now he's in the Hamptons just like George Will shaking his head. Yeah, yeah.
And you know what he's saying, because we've heard it all movie. He's just saying platitudes like, we got to expand. We got to be bigger. Yeah. We got to do more. We got to be bold. Yeah. He's not saying anything.
Yeah.
All right. We can end it there.
Maybe before NAFTA, there was just so much promise about, you know, retaining, you know, the American businesses in our and manufacturing plants in our country. And maybe this movie is just a wild idealist and our crippled, whatever.
This is a horror movie.
Our disgusting, ravaged hearts can't comprehend, you know, the pre-NAFTA excitement about expansion that we were just not connecting with us. You know, did that resonate when you were watching on TNT growing up? This film?
No. I thought this movie was very cool when I was growing up, which is troubling now in hindsight. Because, you know, growing, I was telling Joe this before. You know, you grow up as a white guy in America. You eventually unlearn certain things and kind of learn more about the context and the history and unlearn some of your, you know, privilege and all this. And I remember I had thought a lot of that had come from different places. Now watching this, I'm like, I think I was just unlearning this movie. I think I was just trying to like strip away the like vision of New York and America that this movie ground into me as a kid.
Oh, man. You can try. You can keep trying to divorce yourself from my
I
secret,
love
the secret
movie
of my success.
When I was young.
The movie just, even has a joke where it's just like, oh, you're perfect for the job, but are you a minority woman?
Oh, yeah.
Like,
no,
when
right.
he's trying to get a job, it's just and it's like, what's that supposed to mean? Just like, look, you're actually, you know, if it wasn't for them, you'd be getting this job. It's just like,
the first joke in the film is like a trans joke. He, like, gets off the bus. Three cross-dressers, trans people, they, like, walk out, and he goes, guess I'm really in New York. And then I rewound it like three times.
Yeah.
I was like, is that because it's like he's looking, then it cuts to three people who I like assume there was something like that he didn't like the cut of their jib. And then it cuts back to him and he goes, guess I'm really in New York now. And I went back three times because I was like, what could he possibly be looking at that he said that?
He was saying a Toto. He was saying the line like, well, Toto.
Yeah, I guess we're on Kansas, Kansas anymore. Yeah, but the only
in
thing.
In response
it's not like a shot of the Empire State Building, a shot of a donut guy, a shot of a hot dog guy, a shot of someone going, I'm walking here. Yeah. And then it's just three people crossing the street, cuts back, and he goes, oh, I guess I'm not in Kansas anymore. Yeah. I was like, what is. I literally had to figure out like what he possibly could.
And they do like a crime thing where it's like the city's being ravaged by crime, which
that
of course you could connect the dots on that.
Comedy, like, that scene. Like that scene they did, approximates like what
all
that
can be said for it.
Be,
right? Yeah.
That was seeing this movie, which I haven't seen since it came out. Seeing that, I was like, oh, well, maybe this movie will be kind of heightened and surreal, and that'll be because it was like, oh, this is a surreal thing where he's on this phone. He's on the payphone with his mother back in Kansas, and there's literally a full on crime scene where an old lady's getting taken hostage and stuff. I was just like, well, this is insane. Maybe this movie will be kind of funny in a way where they're poking at this whole thing, but then they stop immediately.
It did like play as like Airplane for like 2 seconds there during that scene. And then, but I think you're right. Like early on in the movie, it's almost like they're checking off all these boxes of like the joke about minorities taking white people's jobs, the crime thing, the like getting off the bus thing. It was like they were checking all of these sort of wink, wink, nudge, nudge, like conservative sort of like, you know, stereotypes. But then they were not interested in like any of the, it was almost just like I don't, it was almost like some weird like loyalty test, like we like right wink wink nudge nudge, you know, like. And then we get into like the fantasy of what we're all aspiring to. It was disturbing to watch this, rewatch this 20 years later.
Yeah, I was just gonna say that we just escaped what seemed like a 10-year, but maybe it's only been 5 years, but it seems like 10, like a 10-year deluge of 80s nostalgia. And everybody, there couldn't be enough 80s nostalgia, right? And we're still dealing with like the after effects of this craze, right? Even with like Stranger Things, like everything 80s nostalgia. All the kids played these games in the 80s, and people dressed like this in the 80s, and the music was like this in the 80s. And everybody, you know, wherever you stand on the 80s, you could be kind of into it or all in or roll your eyes or whatever. But the entire 80s craze, I'm so happy that we are just, you know, I'm moving to 90s nostalgia, because every time, like the 80s, people just want to pinpoint the like four great things. But this movie really in my head is just like, this is what all the movies were like in the 80s. Like the Ferris Bueller Days Off, like those kinds of comedies, they're the exception. They're brilliant. You know, the Ghostbusters, there's like six good movies from the decade. It was just a lot of this. So just the whole entire 80s nostalgia era, I'm so glad to be moving on from, because these comedies, the baseline isn't like Good Faith. This isn't like Blazing Saddles, where you can talk about, you know, the words that they use and the racism of it or whatever. If you have problems with Blazing Saddles, you know, there's an interesting conversation to be had, but it's based on a Good Faith. Like you can trust it as a baseline comedy that Mel Brooks is a good guy who loves comedy and is trying to make you laugh, who's working with, you know, Richard Pryor and the great people to put together this great film. And there's like a baseline of trust, right? So we can talk now about, oh, that was bad, or this was bad, or this was not bad, or whatever. But in this movie, we're kind of listing out these things that rub us the wrong way, because this movie does not enter any of these conversations in good faith. And I find that so much of the output of the 80s comedy, there's no baseline for me to trust so I can enjoy the jokes. This movie never got me on its side, like so many 80s comedies don't. I don't trust you, and then I can't laugh.
Yeah, it's a movie that feels like it was like financed by a bank. It like feels like you could almost at the end of this movie like zoom out, and it was like it's like the training video for some company. Like it's because it is just selling you, like we've said, selling you such like a dream of just 80s, you know, materialism.
Not for us.
Excess.
No,
not for us.
Not for us.
Let's move on to a movie.
Before I go on, one thing. Please, do you know what the secret of his success was?
No, Tom, what was it?
He worked 25 hours a day. It's in the opening song.
I missed that.
The secret of my success. I work 25 hours a day. It's like, that's a terrible message.
Is that in the lyrics?
Yeah, that's the opening thing.
Okay.
Real quick, we do always say things that we did like about the movie. I wanted to shout out Margaret Whitten as Aunt Vera. I thought was doing her best. She was a lot of fun.
She did good. The movie stinks.
Yeah. She was getting as much as she could out of the dialogue, I thought. She was a lot of fun.
I thought Jean, the secretary, killed both her lines. They were both maybe the funniest
part. Jean was fun.
She was just like flustered, and that was approximated human emotion in that scenario. That's pretty good.
You know who I liked?
Who'd you like?
Who'd you like, Tom?
Which is a reference to there's an actor in this movie who deals with ringing, who 20 something years later would be speechless in a wheelchair.
That's right.
Ringing a bell.
He was in last week's film as well.
Yes, he was in last week's film as well.
Hector Salamanca.
Hector Salamanca was in the film. He's fixing the elevator.
He's the elevator repairman, and he has to deal with the ding, ding, and all I could think was he'd be ringing bells later.
Wow. Oh my God. I wonder if anybody in any like interviews for Breaking Bad kind of brought that up in some sort of, did you ever think you'd be ringing bells this much, Hector? Yeah. You know, his name's not Hector Salamanca.
He's like Nick something.
Yeah, I forgot.
1 second. Mark Margolis.
Yes,
Mark Margolis.
Two weeks.
Yeah, 2 weeks in a row with Mark Margolis.
I hope he's in next week's. I was very happy to see him. That was one part of the movie where I sat up and was like, oh, a person I like.
So, all right, well, let's move on to The Sweet Smell of Success from 1957. Most of the art house movies we've looked at have been auteur movies. This is one of the great, they always say this about The Third Man. I think this qualifies as well. This is one of the great collaborative movies of all time. When you're watching those opening credits, it's just like one heavy hitter after another. It's truly amazing. Written by Clifford Odets and Ernest Lehman, which is an incredible pairing. Clifford Odets, of course, famous playwright. And then Ernest Lehman, incredible screenwriter, wrote North by Northwest, West Side Story, Sweet Smell of Success. So you have these two powerhouses. I didn't really read too much about it, but I would be fascinated to know how they kind of work together on this. I know it's based on an Ernest Lehman novella. So he probably came in with the source material, and then Odets, you know, kind of maybe punched up some stuff. But those two worked together in the screenplay. The DP, James Wong Howe, who was just legendary cinematographer, worked on The Thin Man, Yankee Doodle Dandy, HUD. I mean, this guy worked like 30, you know, years in Hollywood, just on so many big movies. And then directed by Alexander McKendrick, who came up in the Ealing studio system in England and worked on a lot of the Alec Guinness comedies, Lady Killers, Man in the White Suit. And then starring two of the kind of icons of late 40s, 50s Hollywood, Burt Lancaster and Tony Curtis. Man, what a group, what a crew. Tom, what were your last screening at New Beverly? I'm so jealous. That's such a great way to watch it. What were some takeaways from your most recent viewing of this movie?
Well, first of all, just seeing it on a screen, because it is just one of the most beautiful movies. It's black and white, and it's just shot so, it's so ominous and so dirty, and you feel the smoke, the steam from the street. All of that stuff really worked, like cinematically, getting to see that. Seeing it with an audience was exciting because there were clearly a lot of people who had not seen the movie before, and people were gasping, straight up gasping at the horror of the two main characters, how low they go at different spots. People audibly gasped when Tony Curtis sells out the cigarette girl, and when Burt Lancaster is with his sister at the end and is willing to just frame Sydney, just like people were really into it, and it was kind of exciting to hear and to hear people laugh at moments in it, like to hear people laugh at those lines, like. Like you're a cookie filled with arsenic. Yeah. People laughed at that. People laughed at cats in the bag, the bags in the river.
Yeah,
like those lines that have always just I've thought were amazing. People laughed at. I love this dirty, dirty old town. What is it?
Yeah, I love this.
I love this city or dirty old town. I can't remember. Yeah, I'm getting it wrong.
I love this dirty town.
I love this dirty town. People laughed at that. Like,
it played. So just it played
from beginning to end. Yeah,
it really does.
100%.
Totally resonated.
Yeah.
And that scene at the end. Where JJ, it's revealed that he had planted, or that he was behind framing, his sister's boyfriend, because one of the, sorry, Joe, real quick, let's do your 60-second review. So everybody knows kind of what we're talking about here, in 60 seconds or less, please recap the plot of Sweet Smell of Success starting now.
Tony Curtis, Hollywood's golden boy, goes bad in Sweet Smell of Success, where he plays a like a conniving young press agent who is kind of down on his luck and is trying to find a good story to get in the papers, can't really put too much together. But he gets a new job from one of the biggest papermen in town, played by Burt Lancaster, who says, hey, if you break up my sister and her boyfriend, Dallas, who's a musician who I hate, if you can break them up, then you're gravy in my book and you'll hit a big payday. And who knows what other gifts will be up my sleeve. This leads into just a treacherous sort of
20 seconds
disgusting spiral where Tony Curtis and Burt Lancaster kind of play off of each other as they take Burt's sister's life and throws it down the tubes. It's got smoke. It's got newspapers. It's got backstabbing. It's got betrayal. It's a noir. It's Odo Debts. It's great
time. Great summary. Thank you so much, Joe. But Tom, what you said about that final scene with J.J. Hunsaker, where he is, it's revealed that he had essentially framed his sister's boyfriend. He's trying to break them up, which
in front of the sister. The sister's hearing this for the first time.
She finally hears it for the first time. And she had just tried to kill herself. She just tried to jump off the roof of their building. He says to her, and this struck me so much in this viewing, he says to her, just like we know you didn't just try to kill yourself, you can trust that I didn't do this. Mm-hmm. And he's telling that to her knowing that everybody knows she just tried to kill himself. He's literally rewriting reality in front of everybody and saying, like, we don't do reality, we do my version of it.
He's powerful enough to bend reality, or at least he believes he has been. He's been trained to think he can shape reality. Yeah. And Tony Curtis, to a lesser degree, when these guys are planting, either they're hyping somebody in a positive way in the columns in the papers, or they're slandering and smearing and ruining somebody, they're just used to believing they control reality, and it gets away from both of them in the end, and they both realize that they both just lose.
Yeah. And it's interesting that the game of this movie is so interesting too, because usually in a game, like in a movie like this, where there's like people are conning each other and there's lies in this, there's some degree of like illusion where people don't know each other's motives. I feel like from the very first moment, it's established that everybody knows that everybody else is rotten.
Yeah.
And so it's like a different kind of game where you're trying to get what you can, but nobody has any illusions about, I guess maybe the sister and her boyfriend are kind of the most idealistic, but even them from the very first scene, Steve Dallas, the jazz musician, calls Falco out. He knows everybody knows who everybody else is, but everybody still needs stuff. So it's just this game of how much can I trust this untrustworthy person, or how much can I leverage them to get something else? But nobody has any illusions about the fact that everyone is rotten to the core in this movie.
Because the sister is ostensibly pure, but under the thumb of her older brother, who has this weird obsession with holding on to his sister's purity and keeping her for himself, not in an incestual way, but in a controlling way.
Yeah.
And her love interest is also seems to be relatively pure in the fact that he's doing these things and he is what he says. Like when he says something, he's saying, this is my truth, and it is the truth. Everybody else is just lying outright all the time, and they'll lie and then they'll tell a different lie as if they just didn't lie about something. 30 seconds, it's what's the next lie. And then these two the sister says, I don't care how rich my brother is, basically. This is killing me. I need to go. I need to escape my brother, because it turns out he was a monster the whole time. Even if she kind of knew it, she had now had proof.
Yeah.
And the two of them kind of escape this thing where every other character is kind of like damned in a way. They are like the damned. Yeah. They are all doomed to play out the string and eventually, because like power is such a temporal transitory thing, temporary thing. they're all holding on to the power for as long as they can hold on to it and get as much of it for, but it always, power always runs out on people, especially this brand of power.
Yeah. And it's so accentuated. I had also forgotten that this movie is basically in real time. I mean, it's basically over the course of one night. And I think that accentuates that, like, I mean, entire like fortunes rise and fall in the course of just one night. I mean, we're not in daylight until the very end of the movie. But most of this movie takes place in darkness in New York. And the entire, I mean, there's such character arc and scope within just this very limited time frame and these limited locations.
But the movie's also great in the sense that despite these guys and everybody's own personal rises and falls can happen on the at any time, there's no indication that tomorrow night won't be exactly the same, where something devious, lecherous, like this is baked into the cobblestones, this sort of conniving, lying, workaround, the selfishness. And that's why the movie is so dynamic and amazing. Not only the incredible performances, which I loved, and I want to talk about Burt Lancaster in particular, who I found to be treacherous and scary and brilliant in this film, but this, unlike The Secret of My Success, which they shot in Manhattan, I just learned, and Manhattan could be anything. Manhattan could be something we could shoot right across the street at Universal.
An office park in Marina Del Rey.
It just looks like a bunch of rooms or whatever. This Sweet Smell of Success indelibly put a stamp on what New York is and what it feels like. And it was one of those movies where even though New York was painted, it was so gross and scary and seedy. It did make me miss it a little bit, Tom.
Absolutely.
It did.
Me too. It brings up there's a certain constant energy to New York that, you know, having lived in Los Angeles for the last couple of years, I realize the obvious cliche of the city that never sleeps and stuff, but it is true. It's just like Los Angeles shuts down.
Yeah. We all go to bed at 10 p.m.
But this place is like, these are night creatures.
It opens with him having like a donut and a coffee at, you know, 10 p.m. at night.
Yeah.
You know, standing there.
Waiting for the first edition to come out.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or at least it feels really dark, you know, in that first edition.
Let's look at that first appearance of J.J. Hunsaker. Let's go to 1955. So Sidney Falco, the Tony Curtis character, is going to go seek out Hunsaker. Hunsaker is the sort of master of his universe, at least from where we start in this movie. And Sidney Falco is always trying to seek favor with him, trying to get in his column, et cetera, et cetera. And this is, he's going to go seek him out at one of his favorite restaurant spots. Yeah, we can play it here.
Hello?
JJ, it's Sidney. Could you come out for a minute?
Could I come out? No.
I have to talk to you, JJ, that's why.
You had to do something for me. You didn't do it.
Could I come in for a minute?
No. You're dead, son. Get yourself buried.
Devastating.
I want to say that at work tomorrow. God, I don't know the context, but
I would love to talk to somebody like that once.
I'm saying it to someone.
You're dead, son. Get yourself buried.
Get yourself buried.
Yes, and they're so confident in
it. This is another is a great.
And like, Tony Curtis, like. Tony Curtis like equally confidently just ignores it because he hears this shit every day. Yeah, right. Yeah.
He's a little rat.
Yeah.
It's so funny. It's like you'd think Burt Lancaster was 10 feet tall in this movie.
Yeah. It's 100%.
And those glasses.
I could shut out the greedy murmur of little men. JJ, I need you here for 2 minutes.
Mac, yes?
Yeah, I've never seen someone sort of dressed. They dress him sort of bookishly.
Yeah,
and yet it does not even remotely hide his physicality. If anything, it accentuates.
It's like as if Frankenstein's wearing a coat and tie.
Yes, yeah,
yeah. Oh yes, Justice Black. That's right. It like actually makes him more menacing.
Yeah,
because he's acceptably, he's like societally acceptable.
Yeah. But you can just feel the like the power lurking under that outfit. It's terrifying.
Why don't we cut your name, young man? Sidney Falco, sir, but everybody knows and admires you, Senator Walker.
Yeah, I feel like Lancaster and Kurt Russell in this era really, like, that was just a new type of performance on film. It's just those guys' physicality and just their, like, there's always something terrifying about them.
Kirk Douglas.
Kirk Douglas, sorry, it's a Kurt Russell.
What, the computer wore tennis shoes?
Go ahead, Billy, shoot.
But they had to create roles like this for those guys because they didn't, they couldn't slot into the like Clark Gable, Jimmy Stewart roles from the previous generation. They had to create these sort of physical, dark, anti-hero sort of roles for them.
I mean, the way this is framed, Tony Curtis looks like he's half the size of Bill Lancaster, and he's sitting 2 feet away from him. Do you believe in capital? I mean, that's unbelievable. Man has just been sentenced to death.
Burt Lancaster's hands on the table look enormous.
Yeah.
Manny, tell me.
He's so controlled.
What exactly are the unseen gifts of this lovely young thing that you manage?
Well, she sings a little. You know, she sings.
Manny's faith in me is simply awe-inspiring, Mr. Hunsaker. Actually, I'm still studying.
What subject?
Singing, of course. Straight concert. And...
Well, why, of course? You might, for instance, be studying politics.
Me?
Well, you see, J.J.,
I mean, you must be kidding, Mr. Hunsaker. Me with my Jersey City brains.
The brains may be Jersey City, but the clothes are Trina Norell.
Are you an actor, Mr. Falco?
That's what I was thinking. Are you, Mr. Falco?
Well, how did you guess it, Miss James?
He's so pretty, that's how.
Mr. Falco, let it be said at once, is a man of 40 faces, not one. None too pretty, and all deceptive. You see that grin? That's the charming street urchin face. It's part of his helpless act. He throws himself upon your mercy. He's got a half dozen faces for the ladies. But the one I like, the really cute one, is the quick, dependable chap. Nothing he won't do for you in a pinch. So he says.
Ouch. Man, Lancaster is pragmatic. I
Mr.
Feel
Falco,
like,
whom I did not invite to Brian, sit at this table tonight, is a hungry...
Thanks. I feel like maybe Lancaster's ultimate Achilles heel is that he's kind of a sadist. Like he's sort of like he's very pragmatic in the way he plays people off of each other and the way he sort of maintains his power. But he really likes watching people squirm. There is something like truly like cruel fundamentally about him. And I feel like that's what ultimately becomes his downfall is that he likes. I think some people just like become this because they have to get by. He really likes digging the knife in and really like watching people squirm.
He's understood in the world of the columnists in this movie. He's understood to be just Ruth. He'll run blind items, and there's other columnists who say like, I don't trade in blind items. Mm-hmm. And there's a moment when a really kind of just an insane moment when Tony Curtis tries to basically blackmail a lesser columnist into doing what he wants because he's in front of the guy's wife, and he's trying to say like, well, it would be a real shame if your wife found out about you cheating. And then this guy actually the wife says, for the first time you've been, I forget what, how she phrased, like,
I respect you for the first time.
Exactly. Yeah. And he just says like, I had a thing with the cigarette girl and it was stupid. And like, but that's just the level that they are all trading in. But there are even layers set, and like the bottom, these two guys are at the bottom of the bottom.
That's
And a lot of, do you know who this character is somewhat based on?
No, I don't know.
Not literally with this stuff, but like this is what Ed Sullivan was like in the 50s. Really? He was a columnist had a radio show before the Ed Sullivan show.
Oh my God.
He was a New York, correct, and I'm not 100%, I remember, I was obsessed with this movie at different points in my life. I've read a lot about it. I might, just to qualify, I'm not 100% sure, I did not brush up on it before this. But that was Ed Sullivan's career, was an East Coast guy who was a columnist and then had the radio show, then gets the TV show because that was the burgeoning medium. And then that brings you out west.
Wow.
And then you kind of leave behind your brutal East Coast ways to just be this. Because by the time Ed Sullivan comes to do the Ed Sullivan show, he's like old or older. Yeah. But he started off as a hungry dude to get to where he got to be.
He was a piece of
Sullivan.
Shit about it. He was like a.
I don't know, but I mean, I don't want Ed Sullivan's grandson fighting me.
Look, neither do I.
Over this.
Hey, we'll take all the publicity we can get.
Jared Sullivan. I heard you talk about my grandfather. I'm going to have to fight Tyler Sullivan.
The Sullivan Estate v. Weekend at Bergman's.
Yeah.
I can't wait.
But it was just like there was such a culture where it was ruthless, and Ed Sullivan was one of the big players because it's a multimedia thing. And it's kind of interesting to think that, like, these guys took advantage of every aspect of media and were famous in multiple platforms.
It's so cool because, like, vaudeville and TV are only, 20 years apart. Like, they went many different opportunities, radio, all that stuff. And these guys did all this. And this is what Burt Lancaster's character is based on, right?
Yeah. And well, it's funny, too, because there's a character Burt Lancaster's character. I mean, the character itself is so relatable and, like, you know, is just as relevant now as it was then. But, like, his actual job is such a relic of, like, this, you know, theater critic in the newspaper who does, and certainly there's modern parallels, but that specific job seems like such a relic. But then you think, like, there's a character in All About Eve, the George Sanders character, Addison DeWitt, who's basically the same character. He's like a theater critic who, like, lords power over people. Mm-hmm. So it was almost like briefly an archetype or a trope, this, like, theater critic who had to curry favor with.
So he's, like, just the theater critic in this? Because he's behaving like William Randolph Hearst.
It's more of a, it's expanded into a gossip column. But
he's a big sort of glossy column.
You look at it at this point, that was just a politician. He was sitting down with a senator.
Yeah.
He's running real business. Now, he's actually has his hands in politics is what they're saying with this, is how powerful this guy is that he can make or break a politician. Mm-hmm.
Well,
so
Hearst is a great example because Luella Parsons or Hedda Hopper was Hearst's, like, one of those two was, those were the two, big, right? And one of those was like Hearst's,
and Hearst is like attack dog
essentially. Yeah. And it's a thing, it's a profession where, like, I think it was all centered around culture and entertainment and theater and movies, but, like, would very quickly, based on who you were working with, could very quickly veer into politics or this. You were just in the gossip business, essentially. And, like, that sort of mostly, I feel like, centers in entertainment, but then obviously can, like, drift into other areas. But that person was a powerful, and again, there are, of course, I mean, like, TMZ, whatever. There's, like, very equivalent things, you know, Gawker, whatever.
He said he has an audience of 60 million. It's someone who 60 million people read and trust. So if he's like, this guy stinks or this guy's good, that can really make her.
That's the difference. The thing is, like, it was like personalities, million, like singular personalities that you could pinpoint that had just, like, incredibly disproportionate amounts of power.
Yeah.
Let's go to that scene that caused people to gasp in the New Beverly. This is 3905.
This scene's so scary and good.
This is and this will be the final scene we look at. This is Barbara Nichols.
This movie's scary. This movie's so good.
Yeah.
All of the scenes, and it's so well written. I mean, it makes sense, you know, once you know who wrote it. But that scene, this scene is well written. The scene when Tony Curtis and Burt Lancaster meet up with the sister in Dallas in the theater, and they're all sort of, they're just lying out their ass, and the other two are just, like, telling the truth out their ass, and how they twist it and turn it and make allies and, like, destroy allies, like, in three sentences. It's just so exciting to watch the dialogue as everybody's status can rise and fall and rise and fall in different scenes with every passing line. What people, the leverage that's being passed around, what sort of power people have over each other.
Yeah, I don't know.
This scene is probably that in its most depraved instance.
They do that thing where it's like because this line's, the movie's very quippy. It's doing, like, lots of little, like, individual lines that are infinitely quotable.
They're
lots
really
of quotable
cool.
lines.
They're good.
But then it also never loses. Each scene has such a tight structure. And, like, so I feel like sometimes when you get into that, like, quippy, we're like, writing, like, lines, the scene can kind of get away from you a little bit. This movie is, like, so tight at the same time that it has, like, literally 50 quotable lines.
Good.
Yeah, it's unreal. So let's watch this final scene, and then we'll wrap up. And this is Rita, who works as a cigarette girl in a local bar. And,
who previously we saw him, you know, a version of standing up for. And we thought he might have, like, a shred. Well, he uses her to try to get a guy, but, you know, ostensibly he's trying to, not really, but kind of help her out. It seems it seems like they're kind of friends.
Well,
and now he's about to completely abuse them.
They definitely, like, hook up, and she thinks he's coming to hook up But he has brought another guy who he's going to try to pawn her off on in order to get something.
She trusts him, and he's about to ruin that.
That's it.
A younger Larry Tate from Bewitched.
Hello. My friends call me Otis.
He's good. Sometimes they're all really good in this scene. This whole movie's full of great acting.
Otis was real outraged when I told him that Van Cleve was going to fire you.
Hey. Yeah, and Rita's played by Barbara Nichols, who's just absolutely fantastic in this.
Don't I know you from somewhere, Otis? Saratoga. Last summer?
Relax. Come on, take the weight off those lovely games, huh?
I think it's, she knows. She immediately knows what's happening.
Yeah. What else is
but they
doing
still
here?
Like have to play the game and
sure,
the theater
relax,
of it all.
Rita. Yeah. When you look at me, you look at a friend in disguise. Miami Beach.
Haven't been to Florida since I was a little girl.
Well, here's to the time when we played with dolls and dreamed of better things.
Here, Otis.
Wow,
cozy place you've got here,
Sydney. Yeah, good shit.
Make yourself at home.
No, it is
nice,
such a
nice,
dark, cynical
movie. Snug. Otis carries a lot of weight with your boss, honey. He's going to tell him not to pay any attention to anything you know who says about you know what. Right, Otis?
Right.
And now this is Don Holloway.
Why don't you two talk it over until I get back?
Back?
Yes, you know these business meetings are always coming up in the middle of the night.
That's the thing, is like she knows that's
hold
a lie.
Hold on.
Yeah,
you can drop me off on your way.
So now he is going to go in there and he's going to convince her to do this.
I hate JJ, but not that much at this moment.
Look, give me a chance, huh? Give me a chance.
Now watch him work. Watch him be a disgusting little snake.
Don't you know who that man is?
Yeah. Otis Elwell, the columnist.
Yeah.
And he's a perfect stranger to me.
So take 5 minutes. Get acquainted. He's an important man. He's lonely. Don't be dumb.
What do you want all of a sudden? Lady Godiva? Where's my other shoe?
What kind of an act is this?
Don't you think I have any feelings? What am I? A bowl of fruit? A tangerine that peels in a minute?
I beg your pardon. How do you like this? I turned myself inside out to do you a favor, now I'm the heavy. Here's your shoe. There's your coat. And there's the door.
Sydney, I don't do this sort of thing.
What sort of thing?
This sort of thing.
You need him for a favor, don't you? Well, so do I. I need his column tonight. Didn't you ask me to do something about your job? Don't you have a kid in military school?
You're a snake, Falco. You're a louse. A real louse.
Honey, he's gonna help you.
Yeah, Brian, we can stop it there.
Just some Falco duplicity.
It's a world in which, like, you can't be alone because then you won't get anywhere. You won't get anything. You need other people to get places, but no one, everyone, like, the only way to interact with people is by fucking each other over. Mm-hmm. And so it's just this, like, damned if you do, damned if you don't. Everyone is just trapped in this just nightmare dog-eat-dog world where, like, because that's the only reason she stays is she knows she can't lose this connection and what it might bring in other ways. Or she needs this relationship between her and Falco to survive in New York. But the cost of it, the way that he presents it, is just devastating. He's so good in this.
He's great. He's a scoundrel, man.
Yeah.
He'll later go on to disown all five of his children. Do you know that, Tom?
That Tony Curtis did?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
He goes on to disown all five of his children and not wrote them out of the will like a year before he died, including Jamie Lynn, and including a daughter whose name is Allegra, you know, which I don't know who she is, but, you know, Allegra Curtis got written out of the will.
Jamie Lee.
Oh, sorry. Excuse me. Jamie Lee. Yeah. Who's Jamie Lynn?
Britney Spears.
Britney Spears' sister. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She's not in the will either.
This,
But anyway, Curtis is great. So the movie it doesn't show any glitz and glam. It shows none of the what they get for all of this mm-hmm. debauchery, what all this sin. We don't see the fruits of their sinful labor.
Mm-hmm.
But Tom, what about the film when you leave? One of the thoughts in your head is, man, I kind of want to go back to New York. When I watched it, I was like, oh man, next time I'm in New York, can't wait. I'm going to drink coffee on the street at 10 p.m.
I think that's just
it. What is it?
I think it's just that it's there's 100 things going on and you get to take your pick of which ones you want to do.
Yeah.
And it's to go to the point of Tony Curtis and to Burt Lancaster, who they're both big movie stars at this point.
Yeah.
And they take on this movie that they're just not, it's so unflattered. Both of these characters are just monsters. And it's such an actor's turn for somebody who, like Tony Curtis, was just a pretty boy.
Yeah.
And now he's getting to do something where he's not just going from movie leading man role to leading man role. It's like, these are character work mm-hmm. they're doing. They're both going against type. Burt Lancaster is in a suit the whole time and moves very deliberately and never not punching anybody out in it or getting in. There's no action scenes in the whole movie for either of them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're just doing it's like a stage play mm-hmm. as a movie. And it's just amazing to see them both kind of lean into these characters as hard as you can, because they are just they really bring them to life. And this is one of those movies where it's a perfect storm confluence of everything working at the same time. It all works. It looks great. The dialogue is great. The story is interesting.
Yeah,
the attitude is shocking to have this, because it's like we always think things in the 50s are a certain way.
Right.
And you see this is like right dead in the middle of the 50s, 1957. And this is one of the most cynical movies I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
It's not like Happy Days or anything like that. Yeah. That's a million miles away from what this movie's about.
Yeah,
I kind of can't believe the movie exists.
It feels like a miracle of a movie, and it feels like we're right around, speaking of like that, you know, it feels like a movie that does blend theater and film together. It feels like we're right around the corner from that like Elia Kazan era of kind of like,
mm-hmm.
right?
Clifford Odets, you know, was in the group theater with
exactly.
Elia Kazan,
yes.
and they all trained under Stanislavski.
Yeah.
And, you know, Meisner was there and Strasberg was there and all them, and they were all boys. So Elia and Clifford Odets and everybody hanging out at this time, they would have shared all this experience together. So that makes all the sense in the world. And also that whole, like, the method was hot right now in acting. It was all coming from the group in New York. And when Burt and Tony Curtis probably had the opportunity to like, oh, fuck, finally, I get to do some acting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They were really ready to chew that up. And when this movie screened in L.A., when they first bring it out, everyone was like, no, 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 please have Burt do his thing. Please have Tony Curtis do his thing.
It wasn't this an immediate hit. Like, it wasn't like an immediate critical hit.
Exactly. Yeah. But apparently they screened it in New York.
Yeah.
And everybody fucking loved it.
Yeah.
Because they fucking got it.
Yeah. Because this is that era where,
they'd seen this kind of acting
and
they'd seen the fucking city and they knew how true this rang. And they, you know, New York's just a more, it's all, it's tales old time.
Yeah.
They made a good choice.
And the other person that I should have said, Walter Winchell is the other columnist who was a big player who is cited as a influence on the character.
Yeah.
Amazing
who
movie.
Ed Sullivan took over for, if I remember correctly.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, Winchell. Yeah, and this is like, this is such a this period is so interesting to me in film, and we'll wrap up after this. But this is this period in the 50s where, because obviously, the 50s you think of it as Eisenhower and Leave It to Beaver and all this, but the movies of this era are so interesting because the studio system has kind of collapsed at this point. There were like different anti-monopoly and antitrust things that kind of brought down all the old studio systems. But you haven't got into New Hollywood yet. You haven't got into like mm-hmm. just the full-on like, you know, kind of transgressive, progressive cinema of the 60s. And so you have all these in-between movies that I think play, a lot of these play better than some of the like New Hollywood stuff now that seems
absolutely.
A little dated, where something about like there's a lingering structure of Golden Age Hollywood here, but then there's this like the dialogue and the content is allowed to be so much darker and more cynical than those movies. So that combination of this sort of familiar genre, I mean, this movie's short, it's fast. It, you know, has a couple locations, it has recognizable actors, but man, yeah, like we've said, they're all going to a very dark place here that really just makes this movie absolutely timeless. So I think we've, any final words? Good. Okay. Tom, thank you so much for hanging out with us.
Thanks
for
having me.
This was a marathon. So thank you so much.
That was great.
We really appreciate this.
Sincerely. Thank you.
Exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. The best first guest we could have hoped for. This was such a fun pairing. I don't think there's any mystery.
Right. No.
Yes, but we will, if there's no objections, we're putting Secret of My Success at the bottom of the trash can.
Yeah. It's at the
bottom. You join She's Out of My League.
I think She's Out of My League might be worse.
I don't know.
She's Out of My League.
But only like by a fraction. And the red
shoes. You look in the garbage can, you see the red shoes is in there.
Toss it in there. No, the red shoes. Red shoes.
Oh, no.
Red Shoes is in made the canon. Showgirls is in the trash.
Showgirls
can.
Is in.
By the mercy of our listeners,
throw it in there with Seven Seal and Showgirls. Seals.
Okay,
and we're gonna have to do an Inferno thing where there's like circles of hell because
no, we won't. Oh, fine. I would love to do that. Why did I say no?
Why not?
I want to make sure that every week we really want to like break up the trash cannon, but I think we have to stay with we have to stay true. We can put it in tiers, but if it's in that trash cannon, Brett, you're not watching it.
No. Yeah, no, I'm definitely not.
All right, we can tier it up. That's fine.
So Secret of My Success, you're in the trash cannon. Sweet Smell of Success, welcome to the cannon.
Absolutely.
This was such a blast. Thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you.
Next week, we have another listener programmed episode. Two movies about unsupervised kids. We're going to be watching Gummo and Home Alone. Gummo versus Home Alone next week. That one's going to be
fun. That's a good one.
I have no idea. I have no idea.
I don't know what's going to happen.
I will say, spoiler alert, there was no way I was putting Sweet Smell of Success in the trash can and kind of going into this week. No matter what kind of nostalgic spell Secret of My Success cast over me, which it didn't. That was kind of a
given,
though.
But this is a
Gummo Home Alone. I have no idea. We'll have to see. So thank you so much for listening. Follow us at Week in Bergman on Twitter and Instagram and TikTok, and we'll see you next week.
Forever Dog.
This has been a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. For more original podcasts, please visit foreverdogpodcasts.com and subscribe to our shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up with the latest Forever Dog news by following us on Twitter and Instagram @ForeverDogTeam and liking our page on Facebook.